In terms of regulatory status, this the principle of HIFU has been studied for more than 50 years, actually. But as far as prostate cancer is concerned, it's been approved in Europe for about 20 years now, along with other countries around the world. But it's been only recently approved by the FDA. So a few devices have been cleared initially towards the end of 2015, and more recently, the latest addition to that group of devices cleared here in the U.S. is the Focal One. Next. HIFU adoption around the world. So there's been more than 70,000 treatments of prostate cancer with HIFU. The vast majority of those are primary prostate cancer patients that be treated with high-intensity focused ultrasound. Here in the U.S., because of this late clearance, we estimate about 3,000 patients treated so far in the past couple of years. And once again, about 95% of patients were treated for primary prostate cancer treatment at large academic institutions that acquired the devices, but also some ambulatory surgery center. It's an outpatient procedure. As I said, the majority is first line, a little bit of salvage, and whole gland and partial gland, more and more partial gland ablation, one of the pluses of this technology, this ablative technology, is to be able to destroy part of the prostate where surgery cannot do, because surgery can only take the whole prostate out, the whole gland. Next slide. In terms of reimbursement, so CMS has created a HCPCS code towards the middle of 2017. That was initially urology APC level 6, been determined shortly after as a device-intensive procedure. Around the same time, NCCN guidelines have included HIFU as a recommending therapy for radio-recurrent prostate cancer. So at the same level as surgery and cryotherapy for those patients, which led some private payers to start covering for HIFU in this specific salvage setting. And a first Medicare administrative contractor issued a positive LCD, a positive article, actually, for HIFU in the same salvage setting last year, and they're actually retiring it as we speak because of the unintended side effect that we'll discuss towards the end of covering only salvage. And last but not least, recently the EMA, because of the wide body of evidence, awarded HIFU with a CPT Category 1 code, which will become effective January 1st, 2021. So HIFU, even if it's pretty new therapy in the U.S., has been out there for a long time, outside of the United States. And there are more than 100 peer-reviewed publications covering different utilization of HIFU prostate cancer, long-term, large cohort, multicentric, some looking at primary prostate cancer, some looking at salvage, whole gland, hemiablation, focal therapy. I'm not going to go through the whole 100 patients or more. Just look at a couple of salvage publications. The first one, which is one of the largest one in the salvage setting, 418 patients that all had a primary radiation therapy that failed, and they were treated by HIFU, and about 81% of those people were free of metastasis 7 years after the HIFU treatment, which is remarkable for this setting of patients that have a very aggressive disease that already failed the first line of treatment. Next slide. Please, the combination of this large cohort European series of 400 patients and this paper on 100 patients treated here in the U.S. and in Canada as part of an FDA trial, which is shorter term, but the combination of the two articles led the NCCN to include this indications as a standard of care for salvage patients, as well as, I think, lead to this article in LCD that we're talking about today. HIFU, as I said, is not limited to salvage, and actually the vast majority of the literature is for primary patients. First, for whole gland therapy, there are some number of large cohort of patients that have been consecutive patients that have been studied, and you can see throughout articles from different countries and different groups, totaling up to 17 years of follow-up for some of them, that the 10-year cancer-specific and metastasis-free survival is extremely high, even for intermediate and high-risk patients that have very aggressive disease. And click, please. Can you click on this? Yeah. So next to that, you have the similar numbers for the prostatectomy from the series that were published by the Mayo Clinic and the Memorial, which are state-of-the-art prostatectomy centers here in the U.S. So you see that the long-term efficacy of HIFU is on par with the radical prostatectomy, which led to the wider acceptance of HIFU, at least in Europe, and today here in the U.S. growing. Next slide. Beside the Hoagland treatment, so the past 10 years, because of the improvements in the ability to detect with MRI, to detect where the cancer is located inside the prostate, focal therapy has been growing and growing. One of the publications, which is one of the publications that led the AMA to award this CPT Category 1 code, is a meta-analysis following the PRISMA methodology, which has a level 2A evidence that filtered down a 7 cohort study with up to 366 prostate cancer patients that all had a part of their gland treated with HIFU, and all these studies are very consistent in terms of numbers, in terms of results, and what is very remarkable is the side effect profile of this therapy. About 96%, so it ranges from 91 to 100% of the patients are completely continent, fat-free. For the record, with prostatectomy in the first few months, about 70 or 80 patients have to wear pads. It improves a long time, but even 1 or 2 years after, you still have a good 20, 30% of the patients that still have to wear pads after a radical prostatectomy. And same thing on the potency. There's a potency preservation of those patients with this focal HIFU of around 80% of the patient throughout the whole literature, which is once again remarkable compared to what is achieved by with radical prostatectomy, with barely 20% of the patient are able to have erections without any help from Viagra or other medications of that type. Next slide. So this is another publication that have very similar, that echoes really this kind of results and show the stability of the results for focal therapy. I'm not going to go into details. So I have two other publications I really wanted to highlight. The next one is very recently. Next slide, please. Is a multicentric. It just came out last year, so it was not included in all those reviews. Multicentric focal HIFU of 625 patients. Once again, the fat-free continence and the potency preservation is remarkable. It was expected, but it's consistent from one group to another, and it gets with larger populations. And the stability of, we start to have metastasis-free survival, cancer-specific survival at 5 years for patients that have, for the majority of them, an intermediate or high-risk disease. So we're not talking about low-risk patients, low-risk cancer patients here, talking about 84% of them have intermediate or high-risk patients. And recently, if you go to the next slide, hot of the press, another group in Europe has come out with his own series of more than 1,000 patients, and you can see that even at 8 years of follow-up, 97% of the patients are the overall survival is 97%, and with pretty remarkable 81% radical treatment-free survival, so they didn't need any other treatment. They're still oncologically completely perfect, and they have very similar side effect profile. And they even saw an improvement along the time with the improvement of MRI and imaging that helps target even better the cancer inside of the prostate. Next slide. Just to go back to the comparison with the standard of care, which are radical prostatectomy and radiotherapy, if we compare one of those latest papers with HIFU on the top column, on the left column, with the latest results that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine from a randomized clinical trial between radical prostatectomy and radiotherapy in the UK, we can see that disease control at 5 years are extremely on par, are on par with HIFU with the radiotherapy and radical prostatectomy, with a far better side effect profile. You can see, and of note, if you look at the top rows, you can see the HIFU patients had a far more aggressive disease, 72% had a Gleason 7 higher, compared to the radical prostatectomy radiotherapy, where the majority of them are very low-risk patients. Next slide. So as a conclusion, the message I wanted to convey is that HIFU presents a wide body of evidence, thousands and thousands of patients, hundreds of publications, peer-reviewed publications, that clearly support the safety and the durable effectiveness of this therapy, not only as a salvage, but also for first-line patients in both whole gland treatment strategy or a focal strategy. Back to the reason we hear NGS proposed a LCD and article for salvage, we all believe that's a step in the positive direction, but we want to make sure, and we're pretty concerned because of the WPS experience, that this will not preclude a case-by-case processing, at least for the claims of HIFU for initial treatment of prostate cancer, which is the case today. Last but not least, we would request, of course, that all that new evidence on primary prostate cancer would be considered and looked at by NGS for an extension of this LCD or a new article.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. If you have any questions.
Questions, comments?
Carolyn, I have a couple questions for Mr. Embert. Mr. Embert, you presented a lot of information there. You alluded to some new studies. I mentioned that there was no level one data. None of those recent ones are level one either, are they?
No. As it was pointed out for one of the other topics earlier today, it is extremely difficult or quasi impossible to randomize a non-invasive therapy such as HIFU with a radical prostatectomy. The choice of the patient, some groups are trying and have tried, and most of the patients drop out of the study as soon as they're drawn into the prostatectomy arm. So it's extremely difficult. So the best we can do is either propensity score matching or meta-analysis like we have. So we're I think with those 2A level of evidence, that's where we stand as we speak.
And one of your earlier slides alluded to NCCN endorsing HIFU for radio recurrent cancer. Mm-hmm. I didn't see any other anything else. NCCN does not currently endorse HIFU for primary therapy, correct?
Correct. NCCN has not updated their guidelines recently on the prostate cancer side. So they haven't mentioned the primary yet.
Well, they update them every few months. I think I'd have to look, but the last one was in the last few months, version 3 or 4, 2019.
To my recollection, it was early 2018, but you could be right. I'll have a look at my site.
Yeah, I think there's version 3 or 4 in 2019. That's all I had, Carolyn.
Okay, anybody on the line, anybody else on the line that has a question or comment?
As a reminder, to ask a question, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, that's star 1.
Operator, could you please include or comment when you are asking people to press star 1? So question or comment.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Okay, we have two more to go. The next one is fluid jet system and the treatment of BPH. Greg? I'm sorry. My apologies. Dr. Shalov. Operator, do we have him connected?
What was the name?
Shalhav.
Okay, your line is open.
Okay, hi. So I was listening just as a introduction. I'm a urologist. I'm the chief of urology at the University of Chicago. And I've been a urologist since 1996. And two disclaimers. Number one, I have no financial relations whatsoever with Edda Pickelman. So this is one. The second one, kind of to add hopefully some credibility to what I'm going to say, is that when I finished my fellowship, I joined Indiana University in Indianapolis when they were working on their BPH indication for HIFU with focused surgery, what is now Sonablate. And I, as my research during that time, I was interested in kidney, and I said, okay, can we work with this probe for kidney and see if it works on kidney? So I had a very, very productive, you know, scientific research related to HIFU and my knowledge and understanding on HIFU. And actually, the first human trials with the kidney were done in Vienna, where I brought the probe with the company and sat down with Marburger, who was the head of urology there, and we did a few patients where we were using the HIFU probe laparoscopically, and then he would do a nephrectomy, and we would look at the effect on the tissue. Bottom line, it didn't work because I think the kidney is a very difficult site to do it because of the angles. Laparoscopically, you can't cover the entire tumor. But that's my background with my experience with HIFU that started a very, very long time ago. So now to my experience with HIFU, I would add that since then, when I moved to the University of Chicago in 2001, I've been watching the HIFU technology and kind of waiting for it to become good enough to be used where I like to sleep well at night and I don't like to have any questions to myself, did I do the right thing? So, and I didn't feel that it's ready in the early 2000s to do HIFU on patients, obviously not for kidney, but not for prostate cancer. And I was watching it, you know, reading all the science around it, the publications, looking for high-level evidence and so forth, not happening. And as you know, in many things in medicine, you know, robotic surgery started with zero level one evidence and eventually, you know, became approved and established way before we had them. Now we have level one evidence, and obviously it was true. But going back to the HIFU, I was watching it and waiting, and nothing, you know, was convincing enough that I would say, okay, this is something I do want to try for my patient. The last iteration before the Focal One machine started catching my attention, and I started watching people performing it. Going around, I was in Canada, I was in New York, I was in Germany, and watched people use different machines and different companies to do it. And the final kind of decision for me was, once Focal One was ready and I saw it in action, I was happy to say to myself, okay, now we have what we need to do a good job. And what I think now about the Focal One, this is a system that delivers very precise energy to exactly where you want it with real-time imaging. You can decide to couple it to the MRI or not. In a very consistent way, feel that we're getting the tissue that we want to ablate destroyed very, very well. And the studies that you have out there from Europe are mostly done on patients where they did the whole gland with the previous iterations of HIFU machines. And the outcomes were not great. They were okay. The procedure took a very, very long time. The surgeon should not, the operator should not take his eyes off the machine, and it was 4 hours that they needed to be looking at the machine without any interruptions, no emails at the same time or texting. And it wasn't done this way. And there were, I think, many handicaps to the system compared to what it is right now. And that's why the initial results are not as good as, you know, I wanted it to be before I offer it to somebody. So that's one thing, that the evolution of the technology in the last 5 years was such that I'm feeling very comfortable now with the technology. The other concept that changed is the focal or hemiablation versus whole gland ablation. I don't think the machine is ready to do a full gland ablation yet. I think it's a perfect machine for what we call hemiablation, where you take half of the prostate and cook half of the prostate. The whole idea of doing focal therapy where you take, you know, a pea-sized tumor in the prostate and only treat that and leave the rest of the prostate be, I think is a mistake. You need a margin of about 10 millimeters around that lesion to make sure that it's completely destroyed. And that means that basically if you need 10 millimeters on each side, you are going to do a hemi ablation as a minimum. So people started doing it, and there's more and more data accumulating today on hemi ablation, where you successfully destroy one half of the prostate. In my clinic, about 25% only of the patients are eligible for hemi ablation because their disease is unilateral. Significant disease is unilateral. But for that patient population, I think this now has become a very, very minimally morbid procedure to take care of the tumor without damaging their continence and without damaging their sphincter muscle and the nerve if you want to. And I actually am not shy to say if there is on the MRI extraprostatic extension right by the nerve, I tell the patient, I'm going to cook that nerve together. And with the machine as it is today, I can very, very securely include, you know, a centimeter of tissue right on the nerve and together with the prostate take the nerve, or in cases when the nerve is not involved and the tumor is a little away from the nerve, say, I'm not going to include the nerve and save the nerve. So I think that the morbidity, well, that's what I see. I've done 16 patients, full disclosure, starting in May 18 of this year. The problem is that, you know, they need to pay out of pocket, most of them, and it's not easy to get patients to do it. And hence, you know, the effort today to get it to more people. I strongly believe that we can deliver very good care without disrupting the lives of the patients the way we do with both radical prostatectomy or radiation. And HIFU will find its place. It's only a matter of time. We may not do well this year with regard to approvals and so forth. It's only a matter of time where HIFU will find its way, its domain between active surveillance and the very aggressive options that we have, which are a radical prostatectomy or radiation, which we should save for people with bilateral, you know, high-grade disease. And one last thing I want to say, I know I'm talking a lot. I would say that if cryotherapy is an approved procedure for prostate cancer today, there's absolutely no reason that HIFU, the level of delivery that we have today with the focal one, would not be. I pause here because I'm sure that you guys want to ask me some questions.
Yes, question.
Carolyn, I just wanted to ask Dr. Shalev. He mentioned his historical connection to this technology, but do you have any current or recent conflict of interest?
That was my initial disclaimer. I never, ever had, in all my career, I have never married industry to, and I do a lot of robotic surgery, so Intuitive was in the picture and other things, never had any conflict of interest.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions?
As a reminder, to ask a question or make a comment, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone keypad. That's star 1.
Thank you, Dr. Shalhav. Okay, next we'll go to the LCD that I mentioned earlier, the fluid jet systems and the treatment of BPH. Craig?
Yes. Again, this is another new policy. The rationale for this policy is to have a TURP alternative. I don't know if other people can hear that sound, but probably nothing we can do about it. TURP alternative with a more favorable safety, especially sexual function profile, and convenience as well, more convenience compared to TURP. So this is a resective procedure, not an ablative procedure like TURP is. The only FDA-cleared fluid jet system is the AquaBeam system right now. It is a transurethral approach using high-velocity saline jet and a real-time ultrasound, truss ultrasound, to basically map out the specific region to be targeted by the high-velocity saline jet. So, and a lot of this is done by computer. The resection limits are computer-generated, but the surgeon is ultimately responsible for accepting those or not accepting those, and then the resection is then executed automatically via a robotic arm. The hemostasis is via electrocautery or traction. I think the early reports used more electrocautery, and subsequently they've tried to eschew that and just stick to the three-way catheter. The idea is that minimizing heat damage to the erective tissues, erective nerves, theoretically is advantageous in preserving sexual function. One of the notable things that makes this stand out is that there's a very short operative time, a mean of 33 minutes, and actually the resection time is even significantly shorter than that, and it does not seem to be, seems to be almost size independent. So once this thing is locked in terms of a mapping, the machine pretty much, the robotic machine pretty much does its thing quickly regardless of the size. Next slide. Okay. So the evidence here, there is level one data. It's the main data is a single level one study that is now out to 2 years. It shows non-inferiority to TURP in functional indices, IPSS, QMAX, quality of life, post-war residual, and safety outcomes, bleeding, urethral strictures, urinary retention, UTI, et cetera, and reduced sexual dysfunction. Next slide. In summary, there's promising short-term single-study results that have resulted in, at best, conditional recommendations in some guidelines, and they're listed there. A conditional recommendation, grade C by AUA, translates to an unclear balance between benefits and risks. There's a Cochrane review which says any recommendation for or against aquablation would be based on only very low certainty evidence. And this is basically down grading of the existing evidence that I just referred to for various forms of potential bias, despite it being a level one study, and also some imprecision in terms of the wide confidence intervals. EAU guidelines stop short of even a conditional recommendation. There is no current commercial or Medicare insurance coverage that of which I'm aware. And so for now, we're considering this still investigational pending publication of what we generally consider to be legitimate midterm, which is defined as three-year results. I think that's it.
Thank you, Craig. Okay, we have two presenters in person and one on the phone. Are you Dr. Heflin?
No, Dr. Helfand's next. Is it possible for the next for my presentation to go next, or I'm Matt Salkeld?
I think she can get to that. There
Perfect.
We are.
Thank you very much. Thank you. My name is Matt Salkeld. I want to thank the NGS for reviewing the clinical literature and the guidelines as well. And I appreciate the opportunity to comment. Next slide, I am an employee of the company. And during the next 10 minutes, I really want to focus on three things. One is talk about the fact that Dr. Hogg mentioned, the two-year clinical data was published. It's a randomized clinical trial against TURP, which is the gold standard in BPH. That was published subsequent to many of those guidelines being established and are not reflected in those guidelines. The second thing is answer some questions on some of the long-term clinical data. And Aquablation is a resective technique. It was demonstrated in the study that it removes as much tissue as TURP using transrectal ultrasound, assessing it in transrectal ultrasound. If you look at the PSA levels, which are our surrogate for prostate size, they were similar to TURP at 1 year and 2 year. Symptom improvement and flow rates were similar to TURP at 2 year as well, so we would not anticipate any different or long-term adverse events beyond the two-year period. And then lastly, I'll talk on some of the clinical data. So we have the next slide up here. This is just looking at the guidelines that were referenced in the LCD, just the AUA guidelines. All of these were published prior to the publication of our two-year RCT. We now have two-year data published as well as longer-term data that we're gathering now. Two comments I want to highlight is the AUA guidelines were issued in 2018 after the prior version in 2010, but they were amended in 2019, and Aquablation was the only technology or surgical technology that was added to the guidelines, the AU guidelines, in 2019. The other point I wanted to clarify is the EAU requires a minimum of two-year clinical data, which is why the recommendation is what it is, and they will be reviewing our two-year clinical data in their current update. And lastly, a reference in the LCD on the NICE guidance. We have a special arrangement through the interventional procedures. There was a comment in the LCD that it either designates a concern about safety or efficacy. NICE only had our six-month data, but as you see in their publication, they noted that they no major adverse or no major safety risks that they were concerned with. So it was just the length of the follow-up again, which they did not have two-year clinical data available. Next slide. In terms of the LCD, just to clarify a couple points that were referenced, the WATER study was a double-blind study. So patients have been blinded out to 3 years. Obviously, it's impossible to blind the operating surgeon. But in each one of our sites, we did have a blinded follow-up team. So every site had a blinded follow-up team that was separate from the operating surgeon to do that very point of remove that bias. So while it's impossible to do the operating surgeon blinded, we did have the blinded follow-up team. The Cochrane review that was referenced, two things was they looked just strictly at randomized clinical studies, so failed to include our WATER II study, which was a single-arm study looking at large prostates. In addition, it was published prior to the availability of our two-year randomized clinical data. And if you look at the database, there's actually similar sort of recommendations on other or comments on other BPH surgeries. And in fact, there is no Cochrane review on TURP, which is considered the gold standard today. We would encourage the LCD to take a look at a recent publication of in 2018 out of Germany that was a single-center study at 118 patients. The longer-term follow-up is still coming, but demonstrated early safety and efficacy similar to what was reported in the RCT. And lastly, there was a comment about the French study that the data was immature and remained weak. That was an introductory statement in the study, was not reflective of the outcomes or conclusions of that study, and the next sentence went on to say that there's a growing body of evidence supporting the efficacy. Next slide, please. I'll just touch on this. AUA guidelines, as I mentioned, in 2019 were updated, and you'll see there that they were the only surgical technology that was added was Aquablation. And as you look at it, the comment of level C evidence, you'll see that many of the other technologies or surgical approaches in the AUA guidelines also have level C evidence and are covered by all or most of the Medicare contractors today. So the level of evidence assigned to Aquablation is similar to many of the others that are being covered today, primarily driven by the length of the follow-up with the studies. Next slide. So two primary studies we touched on. The first one, the WATER study, was the first FDA pivotal study randomized to the gold standard TURP. And again, it had an inclusion criteria limitation in prostate size, primarily because of the TURP arm, and there are limits on how large surgeons and the guidelines say to use TURP. Similar sort of inclusion criteria to many of the other BPH studies. The conclusions from that study were Aquablation demonstrated a superior safety profile to TURP with comparable efficacy results in all prostates. In a subgroup analysis looking at the larger prostates within that study, it's demonstrated superior safety and efficacy to TURP and similar durable outcomes at 2 years, including retreatment rates, improvement in symptom scores, as well as peak flow rates, which is Qmax. The second study, WATER II, was a large prostate study, knowing that surgeons would want to use it on large prostates, and again, the only FDA prospective study completed for large prostates. The outcomes demonstrated statistically significant increase in symptom improvements at 1 year, safety and efficacy similar to what we saw in the WATER study, demonstrating that it normalizes. Normally, as the prostates get larger and larger, they can get more complex from a surgical perspective. And then lastly, the ability to take an inpatient procedure, as many of these would be candidates for an open simple prostatectomy, take that into the outpatient setting, as 60% of these patients were done in the outpatient setting, and at 1 year we have no retreatments. Next slide, please. So a summary of some of the evidence and durability at 2 years, what you'll see here is kind of two groupings, resective techniques, which include Aquablation, TURP, and green light laser. Those are TURP and green light are the majority of the resective techniques used today. You'll see on the right-hand side here the non-resective techniques, which are UroLift and Rezūm. The patients included in these studies are very similar profiles, so I think fair to look at them from a comparative perspective. What I highlight to you on the bottom are the outcomes, which are the primary efficacy outcomes for these technologies. Two things to note. One is you clearly see a difference in outcomes on symptom improvements or flow rates in resective versus non-resective and the impact of removing tissue. The second thing to point is that if you look at the results in the Aquablation arm compared to TURP, either from the WATER study or from the Goliath, which is the landmark study for laser compared to TURP, you see very similar improvements in symptom scores, improvements in flow rates, and comparable retreatment rates at 2 years. Next slide, please. Just kind of summarizing this, this is a published study from 2009, which looks at 11,600 discharges, and it looks at the freedom from retreatment in TURP compared to laser. You'll see here this goes out to 4 years, about an 8% retreatment rate in the TURP arm, which is generally well accepted at about 2% per year. As you look at the laser arm, higher at 12%. What I've plotted here is you'll see the TURP from the WATER study, so the retreatment rate from the TURP arm in the WATER study at 1 year and 2 year, and then the Aquablation as well, which is right in line, and there's a very linear progression in terms of retreatment rates for TURP. We do have some preliminary 3 year data from the WATER study, which shows no additional retreatments after 2 years, and put 40% of the patients in, and assuming that's what that last little shaded dots represented, assuming that holds out, you'll see well within the linear results that we've seen in other published studies. Next slide. On the WATER II study, one thing to note, this was our large prostate study. The average prostate size was 107 grams, which was 2 times the size of the prostates included in the WATER study. Next slide. And in summary, the WATER study results demonstrated very similar safety and efficacy to the WATER study, which was the smaller prostates. You'll note here that average length of stay was 1.6 days, perioperative transfusion rate of 6%, and you'll see if you compare that to a large meta-analysis of open prostatectomy, which many of these patients would have been incurred average length of stay of 5 days and transfusion rate of 24%. And this just compares it to other transurethral procedures, and you can see that the outcomes are very encouraging. Next slide. Summarizes the challenges of using a transurethral approach for large prostates, whether you look at TURP, procedures that go longer than 1 hour and the resection time gets longer and longer as the prostates get bigger, complications associated with transfusions, TUR syndrome can be seen with laser. There's reported higher rates of retreatment that are seen as well as long procedure times. Open prostatectomy cannot be done in the outpatient setting. Some of the new less invasive techniques that are not resective are actually contraindicated for prostates over 80 grams. And HOLIP, which is the other one that may be discussed, is less than 5% of the procedures being done worldwide due to the learning curve. And you can see one of the consequences are a high rate of transient incontinence in those patients as part of that learning curve. Next slide. So in summary, you know, the technology has been studied to the gold standard, demonstrating similar improvement in symptoms and efficacy. We obviously a superior safety profile with a lower rate of sexual dysfunction, and in large prostates, the opportunity to discharge patients quicker, provide a lower transfusion rate, and a lower lower risk of complication compared to other technologies that are available today. So, in summary, next slide, please. Actually, last slide here is these are just some of the sites that actually Aquablation in NGS. And the number of claims have been submitted, so you'll see quite a few that are, despite the current non-coverage LCD, that have adopted Aquablation and have systems placed in their institution. And we do have some claims that have been submitted, including fee-for-service as well as Medicare Advantage. Next slide. So, again, consistent with the other BPH procedures, request coverage for the Aquablation, the code 0421T, based on the clinical evidence, including the two-year clinical data demonstrating safety and efficacy comparable to other surgical techniques that are available, added to the AUA surgical guidelines. Medicare did award new technology add-on payment for the inpatient setting, demonstrating a substantial clinical improvement over existing treatment options. And then the ability to treat large prostates in an outpatient setting and very reproducible and regardless of the prostate size, unlike other transurethral approaches. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Haug, questions?
I just had one question. Is there is in process to get a Category 1 code rather than the T code?
Yes, we did. We don't have the final results. We did have the submit an application. The AUA submitted the application at the last AMA CPT panel meeting, and we're waiting the final outcomes of that.
Thank you.
Any other from the room or on the line?
As a reminder, to ask a question or make a comment, you will need to press star 1 on your telephone. Again, that's star 1.